Yes, it was. Oh, well, then there's those cartridges. Sure, I think being the number one maker of
that's
it.
Right. They had a brush dusty thing in the front.
But,
yeah.
Yes, but it only cleaned the record after the stylus. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the irony.
Hello, this is Not an Audiophile, the podcast. I'm Andrew Hutchison, and today we have David Carrazza here with me to help us celebrate the Bose takeover of Macintosh, probably not celebrate, and of course discuss various hi-fi gimmicks that perhaps should have never existed, and maybe hi-fi components that we both wish that we hadn't sold. We're back with David Carrazza, and we're discussing news. Apparently, an American hi-fi company, that's a stretch, took over another American hi-fi company this week, or maybe last week.
And by extension, an Italian one.
Yes. So, how odd. I'm not sure what to say next.
Well, I'd like to say something.
Where you go, David?
If the audiophile community, so-called, was a little bit more sophisticated, there'd be a raft of hilarious memes flying around the interwebs.
There would be.
Yeah.
The best meme, the only meme, the best meme that the hi-fi crew could come up with was a piece of Macintosh with a Bose badge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even I could have done that, but...
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I think the takeaway from all this is not so much that a dear old venerable Macintosh has been subsumed by
their arch non-hi-fi enemy.
And you said it, I didn't. But Sonas Faber, who posits themselves as kind of the artisan handmade crafts, kind of Northern Italy type of here we are making the finest instruments, and Bose comes along and essentially fucking buys them.
Mm.
I find that one of the greatest ironies in the industry over the past 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. Mind you, Macintosh Group, I guess you have to refer to them as.
Correct.
Buying Sonas Faber in the first place was a little bit of an odd conjunction, because I'm not sure that there was ever Macintosh powering Sonas Fabers before they were... owned by Macintosh.
And never once have I spied such a beast.
Yeah, but there's a lot of it now.
Oh, yeah.
So now I guess there'll be the same Macintosh equipment, rack of multiple similar-looking blue-lit equipment powering giant Italian speedboat-looking loudspeakers, but with a pair of... Well, what can we choose from the Bose lineup? What will we add from Bose to that system? A pair of noise cancelling headphones, perhaps?
I don't know.
There's nothing to add.
Look, honestly, as I said a moment ago, this is so ripe for exploitation in the meme world.
Do you have any thoughts on what those memes could be?
Modesty forbids me.
Yes, it's. I looked up. I went to the Bose website because I have had some contact with Bose recently, and I needed a spare part. But I'll come back to that story in a second. But I had a look, and it said, products. So I clicked on products, and then it has three choices: earbuds, headphones, and speakers.
Yep.
Speakers is something Bose have always done, of course.
Correct.
That is what they started doing. And they had a pretty interesting range of loudspeakers back in the day, which many would, in the hi-fi community, would regard as some as curious, some interesting, and some silly. They all kind of sounded like a bit of fun, and they sold in huge quantities.
Indeed.
And they got rid of that, and no one knows why, really, except them. But speakers now consist of a variety of plastic mouldings with garbage electronics in them, with perhaps some patented Bose ideas, but mediocrity abounds, from $299 to $999. Not a hi-fi product. Various types of Bluetooth speakers and things. A few earbuds, and I see six pairs of headphones. So that business, they managed to turn an enormous, the best known hi-fi brand in the world, in the 70s and 80s, such a great marketing company that they were, with interesting looking products that sounded kind of, well, saleable, sold by hi-fi stores back in the day, by the way.
Absolutely, you know, we forget this.
I was one of them, bizarrely. So huge business, huge presence in various countries in the world, lots of local offices, enormous turnover of boxes, pallets and pallets and pallets of speakers sold every week. So they managed to get rid of that over the years, having invented the lifestyle system, which they then patented the term lifestyle, which is the case on their brochures. You see a little C or a R or whatever the... I've forgotten now, but I always wondered about that, but I'll come back to that as well because they love to sue people. So they've run this business down over the years to the four pairs of earbuds, the six pairs of headphones, and the random collection of odd-bod speakers. But to fix that problem, we'll buy Macintosh and Sonos Faba. And then, so what happens now, do you think?
Very, very good question. I think, like a lot of acquisitions, if they're wise, they'll leave the acquired companies be. They won't change any kind of management structure or anything like that. They'll, you know, I mean, obviously, Macintosh and certainly Sonos Faba, in and of their own right, are doing rather well. They have been doing so for many, many years. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But as we know in the corporate sphere, many weird things can happen.
It's, Macintosh, I feel in the last, 15 years, maybe 20, have gone from sort of being lost to a huge force in that part of the market by very careful branding, good quality, good sound, you know, if you like that sort of thing, which is, I mean, it's a very nice sound that nice is good. In the luxury end of the market, I guess, and Sonos Faba, of course, always been pretty good at what they do, and probably powered ahead under Macintosh ownership. But I'm just not sure that Bose can leave it alone. Now, Bose is interesting. So, Bose, when Dr. Amar kicked off, his shares went to MIT. So they own. The university owns the business, at least a majority stakeholding, so according to Wikipedia, and so I don't know that to be absolutely true, but that's what the internet tells me. Now, I'm not sure about universities and business. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, what's the difference these days?
Ah, yeah, well, nicely said, I guess, yeah. Yeah, biggest export industry in Australia is university education
pretty much
bigger than mining or something?
Yeah, pretty much. It's just absurd. If you look at the metrics, universities aren't in the business of actually promoting critical thinking or even empirical knowledge anymore. It's a cash cow. Can we just be frank about this?
Oh, seems
I can say this because I taught in one for a number of years.
Yeah, well, you've seen it from the inside.
I saw it firsthand and I just thought, WTF. Yeah, I could tell you some stories that would make the hair on the back of your neck stand up in terms of who gets admitted, how much they pay, and what special privileges they get academically.
Yeah,
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I can guess what one of the privileges is. And I don't have a huge amount of further thoughts on the takeover except to give you an indication of where Bose are at with customer service, which is something they proclaim quite heavily on their website is their forte.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't understand that. Now, in the 90s, I would say, yeah, they were pretty good to deal with from a dealer point of view. They were quite professional and probably a typical American company, organised, you know, things happened pretty quickly. No problem with money, plenty of stock. That seems like that's changed. So you ring up the one, I think it's a 1-300 number to buy a spare part. I'm not sure on their phone answering system whether there's a number to press for actually for spare parts. I think that's hidden under others or miscellaneous. So they're not too concerned about spare parts. But this particular client had a pair of the last series of 901s, the Series 6 version 2.
Wow.
So they were the very last. I couldn't quite remember when that was, and I haven't looked it up, so I'm going to make a mistake. But I think it feels like it was 10 or 15 years ago, but it was possibly longer. But so, you know, mid 2000s through to 2010, I guess. There was a handful of pairs left, and they bought them. And one of the drive units had gone open circuit, and we'll leave out the reason why, because that was very special, but that it was not the product's fault. I thought, oh, well, you know, 901 driver, right? Probably the most common, relatively inexpensive driver on the planet.
That's
right?
a reasonable assumption. You would think, you know, considering they had, what, 9 in each box?
There's 9 in each box, and in fact, I've got a quiz on the 01 series of Bose loudspeakers, which I was reserving for another episode, but now that we're talking Bose, we can perhaps talk about that, because very exciting. But but it involves memory, which you may have of the 01, you know, like 601, 501s, whatever. We'll come back to that. Remind me. So, 9 drivers, 3 screw holes, kind of a weird triangular-shaped driver. They used that frame in all sorts of products, but different voice coils. But the 901 had 9 drivers, as I've said, as you said, but wired in series, all of the impedances were the same at kind of 0.7 or something, or 0.8 or whatever, less than an ohm impedance, so wired in series to become more or less a 7 or 8 ohm speaker. I think they were rated as 8 ohm on the back, on the sticker, or on the underneath, as I should say more correctly, because on the back there were some kind of jet engines installed. Right.
It was like a DC-8.
It actually kind of was, wasn't it? So very of the era, very 70s, and really pretty, I think, a pretty cool design, you know, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The era. Iconic. Yeah.
Yes. And so I thought, I want to get a driver. There are aftermarket Chinese copies on the internet, but I thought I'll ring Bose and surely they'll have them. Now, this was coupled with the Instagram post, maybe fake, of a 60th anniversary 901. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't. That's interesting.
It's sort of a worse looking 901. They've sort of made the top and bottom panels thicker. They put more of a radius on them, and the classic hourglass stands have been kind of ruined and made sort of thicker looking. And
this is from Bose themselves.
Well, I had trouble working that out, and it's from another company, but I kind of thought it was a fake posting or a fake product, like an AI thing.
Yeah, who knows?
Hey? I don't know. So I didn't put too much weight on that, but I thought, well, you can hardly deliver a 60th anniversary 901 without 9 of these drivers per box.
One would think.
They must have millions of them in stock. I'll ring them up. Eventually I get through to someone quite helpful in Manila or somewhere, and certainly not in Sydney. Not in Los Angeles or not in Massachusetts either, so judging by the accent, which I can't judge. But then judging by the competence, it was typical call centre levels of competence. So they're working from the script, not able to really understand what I was saying. But eventually, with the aid of her, she was very helpful, very professional, but didn't know anything, and not her fault. And she got her her manager or what have you to assist, and eventually understood what I needed. And they said, oh, that we haven't had many requests for those, I'll check. And came back after a while, maybe 5 minutes, so not too bad, and said we no longer have that as a spare part, but the customer would be a good fit for our product exchange program.
Tell. This is interesting.
Yeah, this is interesting. I thought, maybe this 60th anniversary product does exist.
And it might be part of the exchange.
Yes. You might be able to trade in your old Series 6 901s for a Series 7, if that's what they're going to call it, or Series 60 or whatever as I say, folks, this product probably doesn't exist. You may have seen the Instagram post and ignored them, much as I did, as a bit of a I don't know, strange fake of some description. So anyhow, long boring story short, the exchange program offering was that for an equivalent product, she made a point to say it's for an equivalent product, which is important.
Well, what did they define subsequently?
Well, the equivalent product is a $999 Bluetooth speaker.
Oh, and, Jesus, and on the stick. Are you serious?
That's what it was. That was the offer. And the offer, I believe, was a $200 voucher or something against the purchase of that if you were to send them the 901s.
In what universe is that an equivalent product?
I don't know. This is not a made-up story. And if anyone wants to test the veracity of this, just ring the number say that you need a 901 part, and that is what you will be told. So that's where Bose is at. So that's but then I could go on about all of the other companies that I have to deal with in my normal working week, and the bizarrely poor levels of product knowledge, customer service, spare parts, stocking.
But seriously, and not a facetious question, why does that not surprise you? Or why does that surprise you, I should say? It shouldn't surprise you.
No, it doesn't surprise me.
Good.
Okay. No. But I thought for the sake of my customer service in my business, I thought, well, what? I mean, I like to cover off on all possibilities.
No kidding.
I'm not going to say you can't get 901 drive units anymore, which I was pretty sure was the case.
Yeah.
Without checking with Bose, because that would have been kind of ridiculous. Now, I checked with Bose on this same thing some years ago, and they weren't available then either, but things do change. And when you see the 60th anniversary product, you think
they've risen from the dead.
That's right. I mean, it would be very easy for Bose to make that drive unit again. You know,
absolutely.
They would just send an order back to Mexico and say, you know, as per 25 years ago, we'll have 1 million of these, please, you know, and they would arrive in a truck shortly afterwards. I mean, I was driving, I've told the story a million times because it's just so bizarre, but there was the joke about when we were Bose dealers that, oh, it's all made in Mexico, and a lot of it was, but I was driving along through a Mexican border town in Arizona, I think, once, and literally a road that kind of paralleled the border. And like I was driving through the main street of the town, and it was like the border was just down that side street, and coming out of that side street was a giant semi-trailer, tractor trailer, with giant Bose banners on the side of it. And I'm like, okay, you're pretty proud that it's made over the border, which is fine. There's nothing, there was never anything wrong with the product that was made in Mexico. In fact, Bose was quite reliable overall. I mean, it's, you know, and I say was because they don't really make anything anymore.
Correct.
And what they make now is, you know, largely throwaway. So anyway, I think I've finished that. We've covered Bose. But good. I mean, you know, it's just I think I said before the show, if you had to think of before last week or the week before, whenever it was, of the strangest takeover, this is not one you would come up with.
Well, certainly not, because just the optics of it are really amusing, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, Okay. Well, we've covered that, and we'll be back in a minute after this ad. Hey, thank you for listening to Not an Audiophile podcast. We really appreciate it, and you can leave comments on the YouTube versions of these shows. That's right, they're on YouTube as an audio-only podcast, and you can review, like, and follow, subscribe, etc. there, but also on Spotify and, of course, Apple Podcasts. You leave comments or score us, and we'd really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Back to the show. Hello, folks. Not an Audiophile. We're discussing the stupidest modifications or tweaks in hi-fi ever. It's actually a short list, because many things that are put forward as, you know, tweaks that will improve your system kind of are. You know, putting isolation doohickeys under your products or your speakers will probably change something, and may well change it for the better. But and I just use that as one slightly polarizing possibility. But one that does get up my goat a little bit, on my goat or up my goat?
On your goat.
Yeah, on my goat. Yeah,
beside your goat.
You don't
perhaps.
Want to get, yeah, you don't want to get up your goat. So
it's not a podcast about animal husbandry.
No, nor do I know obviously anything about it. So by wiring links, fancy ones for $500 or $1,000 or even $200 per four, I suppose. So you take your the supplied little bits of folded bent tin that have been quickly and very thinly gold-plated, and you take those out and you put in these, generally I think they have banana plugs, but sometimes spades, and you put them on the two pairs of posts to link them together for single wiring. Interestingly, you could have bought the bi-wiring cables for the $500, but instead you bought...
The irony is not lost on me.
Instead you bought two 100 millimetre long pieces of wire with rather fancy connectors on them, the connectors being 90% of the value of the product, 99% probably, and you put those on and you are in awe of the improvement. And not only that, you've been instructed by your favourite friendly hi-fi geek forum on the internet that you must connect the positive terminal to the positive on the HF pair of terminals. This is the cable from the amp. And the negative connector on the cable should go to the negative on the LF, because that cross pattern helps with something. Oh dear. And if you ever see one of those arguments on the forums about this, there is so many people who are willing to argue to the death that it is chalk and cheese. David, have you ever experimented with this? I have. Because I'm an idiot, so I've tried it.
You're far from an idiot. No, I look, how do I put this modestly? The short answer is no. The long answer is I don't care.
But why don't you care?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm yet to be convinced that that's really an improvement. I mean, I should really cast my judgment aside until I actually do it, but... From an empirical point of view, I don't think it would work, and I see no substance to it. Yes. I'm running a pair of active speakers at home anyway. So
you're out of that.
Yeah, but I mean, to do it, you know, in the store and kind of furrow my brow and kind of point to Mecca and do all that stuff, yeah. I could do it. But like a lot of this stuff, and, you know, I'm not denigrating the fact that, you know, as you said, quite eloquently a moment ago, a lot of tweaks actually do work, because some of them are grounded in simple physics and electronics, and they do work. But a lot of this stuff, let's not kid ourselves, along with the greater macro level of hi-fi, is, you know, it's confirmation bias, it's suggestion, it's this and that and all the other things.
Indeed it is. Yeah. I mean, it must be, because it simply doesn't. From an electrical engineering point of view, changing a pair of links, whether they be pieces of scrap wire like the ones I'm looking at right now, which they is all it needs to be. Yes, this is recorded in the Hi-Fine Stereo workshop. It's a disaster area at the moment. It was a big week, but there are scraps of wire in front of me. They would do fine. They would probably be better than the bits of folded tin, because those things do play up. They get corroded, and you will get sometimes an intermittent open circuit between your bass and your treble pairs of terminals, and that needs to be fixed, and the best way to fix that is, frankly, a piece of reasonable weight bare wire between the two. And people are laughing right now, going, you hick. But if you seriously believe that you need anything fancier than that to connect the LF to the HF terminals, and then that somehow positioning one connector on one set of terminal, you realise what's going on inside the speaker, folks. There is literally hookup wire connecting the drivers to the crossover and the crossover to the terminals. The same again in your amplifier. There is just literally 18 gauge garbage connecting the speaker terminals, assuming the terminals are not mounted to the circuit board, in which case, do you want to start modifying the circuit board? Because it's a piece of 1 ounce copper, which I've forgotten the definition of, I think an inch by the thickness is... I've just confused myself there. But yeah. 1 ounce board is the lightest thickness of copper on a circuit board, but it's pretty much what everyone uses. And it's it's adequate. Does the job. Absolutely. And you go to 2 ounce board and won't, unless it's a high current situation, you won't notice any difference.
Well sure, but the,
which it is a high current situation with a speaker wiring, which is why some manufacturers do jumper a piece of wire.
Oh God, yeah,
along the circuit board. But to go back to the speakers, come on, folks. You need to, if you felt there was an improvement there, then you should be rewiring the whole thing.
Okay, but hang on a second. I mean, look, you're dangerously rational, and I think we'll have to take you out and shoot it.
I've done the test, and I'm willing to tell you about it.
Okay, but this is emblematic of hi-fi as a hobby, and let's not kid ourselves. It's primarily a hobby for a lot of people. So I don't want to steal Lexus's marketing jargon from 20 or 40 years ago, but it's the relentless pursuit of perfection. Basically,
was that their?
That was Lexus's when they launched the LS400 in fair brown wide land of ours. It was the relentless pursuit of perfection, and you know, to their credit, Lexus really launched with a bang in this country with a car that really kind of shook up everyone. But
it was a perfect car almost, but except for perhaps the lack of personality. But it was
actually derided as the sexless in British automotive magazines, which I thought was rather witty, but only the Brits could come up with that. But I digress. We're not talking about a Lexi here.
Yes,
plural. It's okay.
I'm with you. So
So basically, look, you know, I mean, the folks who are furiously arguing about this, you know, hammer and tong on the interwebs, oh, good on them. That's fine. You know, it's harmless. No one's going to die.
Oh, no. This is not about you shouldn't do it. Don't try it. I've tried it. I've tried it a couple of times, and I could not detect a scrap of difference. And I then was lucky enough to be invited to a Audio Quest cable night at a nearby retailer, the Audio Tailor. I don't know if you know anything about them.
I've heard of them. Yes. Scurrilous bunch of folks.
Yeah, yes. So, generous. And so I was invited to this Audio Quest cable demonstration, and it was a great night because, I mean, we all know cables in a, yeah, on a passive pair of speakers, it can make quite a significant improvement. But I thought it would be, not always, you know, for those that don't think cables are worth worrying about, I would agree that in some cases, and this was an example this night, that in some cases, yes, the improvements are discernible and worthwhile, but for $50,000, I could probably improve the whole loudspeaker for that. But to get to the cable night, so they did start with some affordable cables, and they were a worthwhile improvement for about $1,000 a pair over the starter kickoff pair of, I think they had an old pair of Monster Cable, standard figure eight heavy cables, which, you know, I guess are better than lamp cord. So the start off was okay, and then there was a significant improvement. And somewhere along the way, as they went up through the cables, at some point the gentleman who ran the evening said, well, we'll put the, or maybe it was after the cable demo, we'll do the by-wiring jumper demonstration. And everyone was happy at this stage. I think a vast majority of people had heard a worthwhile improvement in the various stepping up of the various actual cables. And then at some point we went back to a basic set of cables, and then the person, confident by this stage, the person doing the Audio Quest demo, felt very confident that we would all cheer when he put the by-wiring wires on instead of the bits of pressed tin. And silence greeted him, unfortunately. Some small tittering in one corner. Yes, Adam, was it Adam? I can't remember his name. He's a good guy. He's very entertaining. And it was not a rapturous applause moment, and that's because it sounded exactly the same. So we'd been listening to improvements for half an hour, and then he changed this one cable, and on each speaker they took the links out, put the by wiring, retail about $500. Not having a crack at Audio Quest, everyone makes them. Audio Quest makes some great cables. We heard that on the night. Absolutely no problem with Audio Quest, but not a scrap of difference. But then why would there be? So it's impossible for there to be a difference or an improvement. And we're not talking about improvements. We're just talking about differences, because an improvement is, I guess, in the ear of the beholder.
Indeed it is.
Have you ever, David, just moving sideways from, rather than labouring the point with this, but it is an example of some silliness, but what, have you struck something over the years that's outrageous and needs to be exterminated?
Well, I don't know about outrageous. Controversial is probably a better word.
Mm.
But cast your mind back, gentle listener, those of you of a certain age, who will remember this rabid propensity to grab our little silver discs back in the 90s and coat the periphery with a green texture.
Okay.
To stop the light, you know, kind of, otherwise the light would magically refract and, you know, kind of, it was bizarre because all this was predicated on a fundamental ignorance of how CDs were read. But, you know,
green pens.
Oh, the green pens. And not, you just can't go down and buy a texter from the local news agent. Gee whiz, no. You have to buy the
special one from the hi-fi shop.
And God bless them. They made a lot of money. And I remember, too, as a young man, kind of furiously coating the periphery of my CDs.
I also did that once as well.
Yeah.
Because the hi-fi shop that I was involved with actually sold them.
Oh, for sure.
So we had to test it. But
isn't it interesting how, you know, again, this is at the very dawn of the interwebs. It was more, you know.
When it was before interwebs.
Yeah. It was
mid-80s, I guess, is it? Or
yeah, it was a little later than that.
Maybe late 80s, actually.
Late 80s.
You know, CD player sales had slowed and they needed to spice up the turnover a bit.
Well, you know, it was just, you know, again, it was this relentless pursuit of perfection, if I may paraphrase Alexis. You know, it's that whole joke about, you know, audiophilia nervosa. You know, the audiophiles are never happy. They're never happy. Some of them are, but most of them aren't. It's a relentless hobby. And that's not a judgment. That's a simple observation.
Well, I think hobbies are like that, aren't they?
Of course, you know, they are.
We're not really having a crack at the audiophile concept. We love it.
Well, our businesses are predicated upon it, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I'm not. Well...
Yes.
The green pen, yeah, I wouldn't say I've forgotten about it, but I had put it out of my mind.
Sure.
There was another thing also that you did to CDs to make them sound better.
You demagnetise them as well.
Was it that? You demagnetised the aluminium?
I know the metallurgy, the absurdity of, you know, if you knew anything about metallurgy, it was just... But anyway, you know, I've forgotten, but, you know, getting back to silly things in inverted commas, again, there was this thing that was going around. Certainly, it emanated from the US. Certainly, Stereophile and Absolute Sound were kind of banging the drum about it.
Mm.
The Tice audio clock.
Okay, the Tice audio clock.
Yes. I can hear some of you.
I know, that's a very quiet clock that you put on the wall that doesn't go tick, tick, tick and
if memory serves me correctly, and I do have an imperfect memory, gentle reader, you will forgive me.
Yes, reader.
Yeah, well, listener, perhaps. I don't know. What medium is this? Who knows? Well, actually, it is transcribed.
There is a transcript. So you're right. Yeah, gentle reader. Yeah, keep going.
But my understanding of it, you know, all these decades hence, was basically a modified clock, like a clock you used to buy at Tandy Radio Shack.
Okay.
Like a $25, you know, big red LED thing.
Oh, an LED one. Okay.
This is
sounding juicy. So you've got...
No. You can't make this stuff up.
A digital clock.
Yeah, it was seriously an off-the-shelf digital clock, and Tice Electronics, I believe, was the name of the company. They did some jiggery-pokery inside. Maybe they put some magic crystals and it aligned... some kind of extra dimension or whatever. I don't know. I'm being somewhat sarcastic. But anyway, they did some jiggery pokery in the guts and they sold it for, I can't remember how much now, but it was substantially more than the Radio Shack clock that one would buy. Imagine my surprise. It put a zero or two on the air.
Yeah.
And these flew out the door, apparently, because everyone was, you know, kind of foaming at the mouth going, oh, this is it. And I remember a few reviews saying, you know, we don't understand what it does, but it does it. And look, it may or may not have indeed any effect on it, but, you know, this is lost in the annals of time now. So I've never heard one, but I do remember the brouhaha over it. And, you know, that too has gone into the annals of time. No one fucking does that anymore.
What, modify Radio Shack clocks?
No, sadly,
you've got to find a Radio Shack outlet for a start.
So that alongside with the green pen stuff, I just find it interesting how some modifications, as we've talked about, are indeed, they do make a difference, like the speaker isolation thing that you just mentioned before. Mm. Yeah, for sure. And some things fall by the wayside. And, you know, it's just a really interesting thing to go back and see what's stuck and what has just been forgotten.
Well, that's right. In fact, if we'd made this segment, about kooky stuff that's fallen by the wayside, I would need to do a bit of research and remind myself, because I think there was a bunch of them. And this other thing that you did to your CDs, I'm pretty sure was some kind of coating or something, or pen that you – I can't – there was another thing that you did to them that – it wasn't just cleaning, and there was all sorts of fancy cleaners.
I'm going to say this before it falls out of my cranium. Yeah. There was also a German device where you could cut the periphery of seriously, it was a it's like Stellavox made. Stellavox didn't make it, but it was if Nagra Stellavox made it. It was just this beautiful looking machine with this cutting arm, and it would cut the periphery of the CD to make sure it was perfectly circular. Can you believe it? And it sold. No,
dear.
Yeah, there'll be some people jumping up and down. I'm sure there's, you know, in the comments below, as they say on YouTube, correcting us or not correcting us. But it was a real device and you could buy it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's another kooky one. Yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, well, it's not a problem. Interrupt at will. I won't go down that road because I can't remember. But there was a fancy, I mean, it was dishwasher, but not dishwasher in their probably original original ownership, if you like, because dishwasher made great brushes, but for cleaning records, and they made the best stylus brush in the history of stylus brushes, easily the SC2 stylus brushes,
which
actually works.
Yeah, great.
What a shame someone doesn't remake that properly. But anyhow, they had a little machine, a little plastic box, and you put your disc in it, you squirted it with some stuff, and you cranked the handle.
No, I remember it.
And
yes.
It was like a radial cleaner.
Yes.
So no one would use a squirt of Windex and wipe it on their T-shirt as I would do. And I still wipe every CD, assuming I'm wearing a T-shirt, which I guess most of the population is most of the time, unless you go too far west and they're not wearing a shirt at all, or they're wearing a
which would complicate playback
kind
indeed.
Of shirt. But anyhow, the point is that, yes, it would. So they, long story short, wasn't even that long a story. It was a radial cleaner, can't scratch your discs circumferentially. I never could say the word. Which would cause mistracking, of course, but you could just wipe it across the disc. But anyhow, I read something on the internet this morning, briefly, while I was quickly getting my brain to kick out of sleep mode, and that was that there was a thing that you could buy, a bit like your Tice clock. It was a black box, and you could put it on a shelf, and you pointed it at the equipment. It had an arrow on it, apparently. It wasn't powered. It was a passive device. And it wasn't designed
by
Peter Brock,
which is
obviously a local joke when it comes to crystal,
power
of the crystal. But this was, it had something in it.
Okay, right, obviously.
It cost $9.99 US.
$999.
Back in the days when that was a deposit on a house, and you could point.
Are you serious? It was under $1,000, just on $1,000?
I believe so. Hey, this is from the internet, so
go ahead.
You pointed it at the gear. So you put it on it. It was important to have it a certain distance from the equipment, and you pointed it at it, and it would reportedly absorb all bad EMF and other badness that would affect sound quality. It would absorb it passively. But...
okay.
But, you know, speaking of crystal stuff, and it doesn't cross over into hi-fi anywhere near enough, in my opinion. I once was in someone's car...
Here we go.
And he was a nice old guy, but he was a bit kooky. And he was driving like a lunatic, actually. It was one of those old Land Cruisers, big giant, the first big giant wagons. And we're on this curvy road and he is chucking it around, things rolling around like some kind of ocean liner. But anyhow, he goes, I said, what's the... I asked a stupid question. I said, because he's thrashing this thing, right? Like smoke's piling out the back. I said, geez, what's the fuel economy, you know, like in this thing like? And he goes, well, I'll tell you what, as he taps the center console... He taps the center console and there's this little gadget in the center console. And he goes, well, if it wasn't for this little beauty, it'd be using about twice as much.
And pray tell, what was the little beauty?
No, it's just a little box of crystals. You know, it had some name on it. Okay. It wasn't a Peter Crockett. Peter Crock.
I know who you're talking
Peter
about.
Peter Brock invention. Yeah, it was crystal
But was
mythology.
It attached to any
It was just sitting in the center console like a packet of cigarettes.
Okay, so it wasn't on the fuel line or anything.
Oh, no. No, it's nothing even vaguely technical, like a high clone. Okay. But now we're going to go down the automotive
rabbit
silliness rabbit hole. We'll come back to audio.
Okay,
but
go ahead.
He was adamant. I said, oh, really? Yes, yeah. Not only that, improves the handling. Getting closer to Peter Brock at this point. But Peter Brock, nicest guy, by the way. I had the pleasure of meeting him once. He just the nicest guy. But anyhow, he got a bit. He went off the rails there for a bit. But anyhow. Getting back to audio, you got any other? You got one more to round out the segment with.
I've provided three so far.
Have you?
Remember. Well, yeah, the Tyson audio, the green thing, the cutter,
and the cutter.
The
cutter. So it's my turn.
Spare the cutter. Sorry, it's an old song.
Well, you could go into turntable kinkiness. Yeah. There's so many of those.
True.
I think probably the stupidest thing ever. That was invented to help with cleaning records is the auxiliary tone arm with the brush on the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
That you suction cupped onto.
That's right, yes. I remember that.
And, you know, the amount of times that I've had to say to people who bring in grandma's turntable for repair, they go, oh, there's this, what is this? There's a suction cup thing on the plinth, right?
That's right. Where it
mounted.
Yeah.
And they go, well, we don't know what this is for. And you'd have to explain it. And they go, well, that wouldn't work, would it? Dragging something across the record as well as the stylus at the same time. I said, well, I'm pretty sure it didn't help, no. But, I mean, you could just clean the record and then play it. But apparently there was a concern that within 22 minutes, so much dust would fall on the record that you needed to be cleaning it in real time. People are wondering what the hell we're talking about. It was called a dust bug, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was. And from memory, it had a red tufty cylindrical thing.
It had a cylindrical red rollery style.
And in front of
velvety
that,
velvety brush on
it.
The
had
end
a,
of it
had a cluster of.
And then it had a little, a little paintbrush of.
That's right, yeah.
Yes. There's those cartridges. Shure, I think, being the number one maker of
That's right. They had a
brush
dusty thing in the front,
Yes, but it only cleaned the record after the stylus had been
through. Oh, the irony.
Oh dear. I guess there were fibers cleaning the other tracks.
It was a
nearby.
Great idea at the time. I'm sure the marketing guys, just went great.
Can
we'll
you
go
imagine?
With this.
Shure probably put their cartridges on the map, not through sound, but by having a feature that no one else had, which in this case was the real time cleaning brush, which I think on some models was retractable. You could click it up maybe, or am I just getting confused with the stylus guard?
Mm. Who knows?
Yes. Yes, the retractable stylus guard rattling around there on the cartridge probably also didn't make anything better. Not according to Roy Gandy anyhow. Actually, speaking of childhood, 40, 20, 30, 40 year ago, record playing talk was the... there was a fad there for a while of doing the cartridge up to extraordinary talks. Talks? To an extraordinarily high torque, extraordinarily high number of Newton meters or, foot-pounds or something, or pound-foots, as they say in some languages. So, you'd literally get a spanner on there. Many people, DIYers, must have broken the little...
Oh, I'm about to say how much...
torn the head off the tiny little nuts and bolts that hold the things on. And there was also a thing with super gluing the stylus on, if it was a removable stylus, that you should super glue it on.
Wow, I was not aware of that.
There was that as well. And
what, and just, you know, just going to cut to the chase and buy a moving coil if that's what they want.
Well, or a Riga, since they don't have removable styli on their moving magnets, which is another great marketing plan.
Shh, Roy Gandy's still alive. Stop.
Well, there's other news, hey? Indeed, and indeed. We could round this episode out, this segment, very quickly with the generosity of Roy Gandy.
Indeed, it's an excellent story, isn't it?
It is. And I'm not quite sure how it works. No one does, I suppose, except the employees. But the reality is that without the employees, that business wouldn't work. And I guess Roy is... Well, apparently there was word for the last year or three that he was going to do it. He used to tell best friends that he was going to do it, and he's gone and done it. So he's given the company, at least the shareholding, to the staff, which is great, which hopefully Bose will be doing soon. Because, the great thing is that if they do that, is the 16 people that work at Bose these days, actually it wouldn't be that many, would there? Well, there's the guy that does the internet. There's the guy that answers the phone. He's rarely in. I don't know. Hey, thank you for listening to Not an Audiophile podcast. We really appreciate it. And you can leave comments on the YouTube versions of these shows. That's right. They're on YouTube as an audio-only podcast. And you can review, like, and follow, subscribe, etc. there. But also on Spotify and, of course, Apple Podcasts. You leave comments or score us. And we'd really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Back to the show. David, you're back as well in the chair. I'm back on the box, and
God, you are sitting on a box. I've not
noticed. Yeah, I'm sitting on a spare Delacorte prototype, but I do have a piece of cushioning on it.
It's very rustic, I must admit.
It's pathetic, but the thing is, it's the right height for this microphone, and so hence, you know.
It would make a rather fetching cover photo for the podcast.
It's not, because I'm going to buy a chair soon, because I've had a big week, and I can afford a $99 chair from Officeworks. Hey, has there ever been a piece of hi-fi that you owned that you regretted selling?
That's an excellent question, and I love the way you've...
And why did you regret selling it?
Well, I love the way you've couched it with regards to regret, and you didn't use the word best or most wonderful sounding, because they're different parameters. They're different parameters. To answer, and again, as I said in the last podcast, I say this not to boast or anything, because some people say, oh, you're a fucking wanker.
I've hardly heard anyone say that.
Well,
sure, there's a few, but okay. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, you know people. It's, you know, whatever. Anyway, all I'm saying is, I do regret selling the Goldman reference, and I hasten to add
it's... Goldman reference turntable.
Goldman reference turntable, the original.
Made in Switzerland.
Made in Switzerland. They only made, I think it was 250
or so. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, they were 100 kilograms. They came in two massive flight cases. Crates.
Yes.
Wooden crates.
Yes.
And it took half a day to assemble, because I think I had the T5 tone arm on it, parallel tracker.
Oh, okay.
And it was a really interesting turntable, because although it was literally massive in the physics sense of massive, it was on a three-point floating suspension. So can you imagine how that suspension had to hold up? I mean, the platter alone was 20 kilograms or something stupid.
So where was the 100 kilos? It was all in the plinth mostly, other than the plinth.
The base. It was brass. It was solid brass. Man.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, it had a tachometer on it.
Yes.
Readout. And for those of you who are interested, you can just go to Google or your search engine of your choice, DuckDuckGo, whatever, and just Google.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to Google on DuckDuckGo?
Boom, boom. I got a million of them. Keep going. Anyway, and you'll see what it looks like. And it looks like something out of Darth Vader's toy box. The most amazing looking turntable. And the reason why I regret it is, you know, of course it sounded great. It was wonderful. But I regret it because of the sheer industrial design of it. There's nothing in existence that looks like it. It's so imposing.
I must look it up. I have a computer next to me, but it would involve turning my head, so I'm not going to bother. But it's... when you go to a fancy hi-fi show these days, you do see... an enormous amount of over-the-top outrageous turntables.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but this was, I guess, a simpler time and a simpler design, and it was really just massive.
Well, it was massive. And I think Michel Revachon, who was guiding Goldman at the time, just literally gave carte blanche to the engineers and said, just make the greatest turntable in the world.
Okay.
And they did. At the time, there was no contest that it was the greatest turntable in the world. And I've had Linz, I've had Rigas, I've had a lot of high-end turntables, and this thing was just like, you've got to be kidding me.
Mm. Yeah.
But that's why it cost $50,000 US at launch. It was insanely expensive.
Wow, you were feeling rich in those days.
Oh, no, I was in the right place at the right time. I won't tell the entire story, but do you want to hear it or?
Well, I guess you'd broken into a house. I mean, I don't know. Little did you realise this particular job that you were executing.
There is a more colourful version.
The owner of the home had a love or penchant for expensive hi-fi.
Rather, right, yeah, exactly.
No. Can you tell the story?
I can tell the story. I won't tell the full version because it's actually quite interesting, but I don't want to bore the listener. But fundamentally, I found it secondhand in a hi-fi store. I was rifling through a well-known hi-fi store in Australia when I was living in Sydney at the time. And every Friday afternoon, I used to wander in and see what wonderful items have spilt out of the hands of the upper middle class and, were traded in. Because this is at the time when people were kind of reading magazines and going, oh, every 6 months I must change my system, and they do now, thank goodness.
Yes. thank goodness indeed.
And so I was rifling through one of the rooms, and there was all this, mad array of planar speakers and, big, you could almost, kind of insanely complex things here, there, and everywhere. And, of course, the obligatory transformerless tube amp sitting on the floor forlornly waiting for someone to come and love them. And I walked through, and in the corner there was literally a Goldman reference. And physiologically, I involuntarily gasped, and my heart...
You gasped.
No, I did. It was like seeing a fucking unicorn because I'd read about this mythological creature.
Oh, yeah, I know the feeling.
And, considering there's only 250 or so ever made, I mean, the fact that two or three made it to Australia, and there in front of me lay one, kind of beckoning, you don't need your second kidney
Taunting kind of thing. Yes.
So I was feverish. I literally was feverish. I went up to the proprietor and I said, listen, what the hell is that doing there? And the proprietor, in his gruff Hungarian tone, said, one can extrapolate who this might be, said,
yes.
Ah, David, this is from a Perth millionaire. He sells it. He's into surround sound now. And I'm thinking, oh, the poor sod, great. His loss is my gain. And I said, great, how much is it? And he goes, it's not for sale.
Oh.
And I went, oh, shit, it's not for sale. Anyway, the next couple of weeks, the poor bugger, I would literally harangue him on the phone.
Yeah. You ground him down.
Yeah, I did. And at the end of God knows how many phone calls, he literally told me to fuck off, and he told me the price, and he said, I want half in cash and half in a bank check.
And would have happened.
I sauntered in. I'd actually levitated in that Friday afternoon. And the next day it was delivered to my home.
Wow.
Two gentlemen set it up, and it changed my perspective of what hi-fi could be. It was that profound. It was a source, and I'd been working in studios, and I'd work with digital gear, analog gear, blah blah blah.
So you
good source quality as a consumer object that transmitted music so magnificently. I just was agog, and so, I regret selling it, not only because it sounded good, because it was so utterly beautiful from an industrial design perspective.
Yeah. Well, that sucks, because you're not going to get another one of those.
No way.
Yeah, I'm a bit the same, but not with any particular component. I think I regret selling every single piece of hi-fi that I ever bought. Seriously, probably regret it more than selling my records, which I also did like an utter fool. So I had some interesting hi-fi, none of it expensive like yours, but I mentioned to you the System Deck 2, the sponge cake, as it was kind of known in the trade, which was System Deck's second idea of a turntable, but a budget one. And it was quite good. It was not great. It was annoying it didn't have a lid because it would get dusty. And so potentially, I guess, you couldn't put the lid down, and so you did need one of those real-time record brushes nice acting segue, yeah. away that I think we mentioned in a different segment, possibly after this one gets played. I'm not sure. But anyhow, I had a bit of Meridian gear. Mm. I had a pair of KEF transmission line speakers with B139s in them, and I think anyone who's ever owned a similar transmission line with B139s regrets selling them because the bass is of a particular quality.
Yeah, and the 139s were just brilliant drivers for their day too.
As a teenager, they did not play at nightclub levels, so I would botter them out occasionally, and I guess I ultimately mostly destroyed them, but moved them around the country a bit. I had them for a while. They were great. They were rough as guts to look at. They were a kit built job, so they were not pretty cabinets. They were built from a KEF kit. They had a KEF crossover on a connector, which used to go intermittent on some drivers, you know. But I was going to say I fixed that, but I probably didn't because a technician's equipment rarely works much like a mechanic's car. Lots of other... for some reason, I had a number of different open reel machines, which I regret selling.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had a very, very good tape deck I bought new, and it failed quite early, a TAC A660. It had DBX. It made spectacularly good recordings, but then it crapped itself, and I could not fix it. It lost its recording quality. It was some queer fault. I could never sort it out, and I think I just dropped it in the bin. And speaking of dropping things in the bin, I was once gifted a Thorin's turntable, or a Torrens turntable, depending on your level of German, and had an SME arm, the popular one,
a 3009,
I guess was the Econo arm, I don't know. I could not get that thing to work properly. It wouldn't track properly. And I stuffed it in the cupboard and I piled things on top of it and I got it out one day and I went, no, I still can't make it work. I can these days. I don't know what was wrong with me really, but it's a hell of a long time ago and you do get better at fixing things as a rule. And long story short, I put it in the wheelie bin and I really regret that. And I don't know why I did that. I just had one of those, I think I was moving and I'm like, well, I'm not moving this because it never worked. I can go in the bin. Who wants a turntable anyhow? I mean, CD players were king by then, so this is mid-'80s or something.
It's really funny. That would have been born out of frustration of not getting the bloody thing to work.
Yeah, it would just skip a track, third track in, and it would just jump, and I'm like, it sounded pretty good. I guess there was something wrong with the bearings in the arm. It was something kooky. So, and I just, it was beyond me. And frankly, those arms are an amazing piece of engineering, but only the person that designed them originally knows how to set them up, I would guess. So, yeah. Anyhow, you were going to say.
Oh, I was going to say.
Ever thrown a piece of equipment in the bin?
Yes, I have.
Yes,
funny,
but not just... a Goldman.
No, I couldn't lift the freaking thing.
Not in one arm and lift the lid with the other.
No, one piece of legacy gear I had from my studio days was a Panasonic. Panasonic wasn't called Technics. Some people might know this. It's a DAT recorder player, a mastering machine, a 3800.
Mm-hmm.
Great DAT machine. But I had this epiphanal moment one day when I was moving like you, and I looked at it and I thought, hang on, I've transcribed this via Pro Tools into my hard drive archive.
Mm.
Why do I want, what is it, a tiny video recorder?
Yes. Horrible machines to repair, but they were good machines.
That will become legacy and unrepairable in the next few years. And I literally walked down from my apartment and threw it into the industrial bin. I'm thinking, you idiot, someone would pay good money for this. I'm thinking, no one in their right mind would pay good money for this. I toss it. And, that really rankled me because it was a perfectly functional machine, it was of its time. No one wants them anymore.
No. Yeah, I can't say I haven't been requested to repair a DAT machine for a very long time, but I did repair a mini disc the other day and I got it going.
Wow.
And it sounded fine. It was a mid-price Sony thing. And it's not a bad format. I know, I'm pretty sure the audio's compressed.
Yeah, it is.
A bit.
I think they're using Sony Attrack or whatever algorithm they're using.
It was nice compression.
Yeah, I had a Denon one and a Sony one, and I thought, yeah, this is great for, you know, absolutely non-critical listening. Certainly in the car, I had an Alpine.
Is that right? Geez, that'd be a rare bird, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Very rare. But it's funny you should mention mini disc because it never really went away. There's some underground people on the interwebs.
Of course there is. This guy was one. Can you please fix this? He begged me.
They love the format, and God bless them. They're dedicated diehards.
Yeah, no. It's I don't have any hate for mini disc. In fact, I quite like it because the alternative was DCC.
Yeah, that was an answer without a question, wasn't it?
That was a mistake. Yet another Philips mistake.
Yeah.
So I guess it's time to say goodbye. Of course, I don't really know what episode. For the umpteenth time, I've said episode instead of segment. I don't know why. It is early in the morning. I think that's the problem. But hey, thanks, David. Thanks for coming in. We'll make this the last segment, so we can say our goodbyes. Thank you for listening, folks. I know we rambled a bit today. That is a trap. But I assure you, next time round,
we'll be more focused.
We'll be more focused and organised. Yep, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode. See you, David.
Ciao.
Bye.